democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Today's the final day of the U.S. Supreme Court's current term. We look now at several major rulings from the court's conservative supermajority. In a 6-3 ruling Friday, the court approved a power grab by corporate interests who want to strip federal agencies of their authority to regulate public health, the climate, environment, worker protections, food and drug safety, and more. The court struck down 4 decades of a precedent known as the Chevron Doctrine that stems from a Reagan-era ruling called Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, which establishes that judges should defer to federal agencies on interpreting a law if Congress did not specifically address the issue. Justice Elena Kagan read her dissent from the bench saying, quote, in every sphere of current or future federal regulation, expect courts from now on to play a commanding role. It's not a role Congress has given them. It's a role this court has now claimed for itself, as well as other judges, unquote. Some Democrats responded to the ruling by vowing to introduce legislation to protect their policymaking ability. Senator Ed Markey said the ruling would create, quote, a regulatory black hole that destroys fundamental protections for every American in this country, unquote. Meanwhile, Thursday, the justices voted 5-4 to block the Environmental Protection Agency's Good Neighbor Plan, which allows the EPA to regulate air pollution that drifts across state lines. In a statement, Earth Justice wrote, quote, the court's order puts thousands of lives at risk, forces downwind states to regulate their industries more tightly, and tells big polluters that it's open season on our environmental laws, unquote. The Supreme Court had to issue a corrected version of its opinion in the case after Justice Neil Gorsuch confused the air pollutant at issue, which is nitrogen oxide, with nitrous oxide, which he continually referred to in the decision. Nitrous oxide is laughing gas, you know, that dentists administer. He said this more than 5 times in his opinion. But this is no laughing matter. This all comes as the 2 years after the Supreme Court gutted Roe v. Wade and its Dobbs ruling and before today's highly anticipated ruling on former President Donald Trump's bid for immunity from his federal indictment for trying to subvert the 2020 election and stay in power. For more, we're joined by 2 guests. Ali Mistal is the nation's justice correspondent, author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. His new piece headline, We Just Witnessed the Biggest Supreme Court Power Grab Since 1803. And Mustafa Ali is the former head of the Environmental Justice Program at the Environmental Protection Agency, now Executive Vice President of National Wildlife Federation and CEO of Revitalization Strategies. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mustafa Ali, let's begin with you. Let's talk about Chevron. For people who are not following this day and night, explain the significance of this decision.
Well, this decision actually weakens our protections in relationship to clean air and clean water and the land. It says that the expertise that exists inside of federal agencies, those toxicologists, biologists, the others who have spent their life learning and then being able to help to make sure that our country is protected, are no longer valuable. It says that those who are in the courts now get to make the final decision if you are able to breathe clean air, to drink clean water, or to be able to make sure that the land that you're walking on or growing food in, it will be safe enough. This is a very devastating decision that was made. It should have had a warning label on it that said that the following actions are both deadly for both the democracy, for our economy, and for the health of both wildlife and people.
And can you talk about what exactly the decision, Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, what started all this 40 years ago and how this became so important?
Yeah, well, you know, it started because they wanted to make sure that there was actually clean air. So the original decision said that folks in Congress can create the laws. They then move those over to the federal agencies where the expertise actually exists. It also deals with the ambiguity that often exists inside of the law, and that you need to have those individuals who have the knowledge and the skills to understand the dynamics that will play out on the ground. Play out in the ground in places like Cancer Alley or in Institute West Virginia or the diesel death zone that's currently going on out in California. So it was important. And over 18,000 times it has been used, not only in the environmental context, but in other contexts. So it gave those individuals who have the skills to actually keep our country safe the ability to do that. And now that has been taken away.
How do you see this connected, and explain what Project 2025 is?
Well, you know, one, this begins to follow a long line of actions that have been going on for over 40 years, all the way going back to Ronald Reagan, where business and others have been trying to deregulate. They've been trying to weaken the sets of laws that we have in place, the statutes, the rules. And what is now playing out is that we're seeing that there is a shifting of power. Now you overlay that with Project 2025, which in itself is 900 pages of how we will restructure the government. And what you'll find now is that you're going to have individuals who will be put into place who will further weaken the basic sets of protections that are out there, will give business and industry, the polluting business and industry, an opportunity to do more of that so they can maximize profits. And you will find that more folks inside of our country will be struggling for a breath of clean air and a drink of clean water.
I want to bring Ellie Mistal into the conversation. Ellie, the Lever and others reported that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas changed his position on Chevron, one of America's most significant regulatory doctrines, after his wife reportedly accepted secret payments from a shadowy conservative network pushing for the change. Thomas's shift also came while he was receiving lavish gifts from billionaire linked to other groups criticizing the same doctrine, which is now headed back to the high court, they were writing. The Lever notes the so-called Chevron deference doctrine stipulates that the executive branch, not the federal courts, has the power to interpret laws passed by Congress in certain circumstances. Can you talk about this connection and your overall response? Because it's not only about the environment.
Yeah, so this goes to a larger Republican conservative shift on the issue. You brought up the initial Chevron decision in 1984. Let's remember, that was a conservative decision. Chevron was championed by the conservative Svengali, Antonin Scalia, as one of the better decisions to ever come out of the Supreme Court. And the reason why it was a conservative decision in the 80s and trumpeted by conservatives in the 1980s is because conservatives believed that they were more likely than not to hold control over the executive branch. Remember, this is during the Reagan era, right? This is when Reagan looked unbeatable. This is when George H.W. Bush would succeed him, right? So they thought that they would control the executive branch and thus be able to deregulate the environment, worker safety, health safety, civil rights. They thought they could deregulate through the structures of the executive branch. And so they loved Chevron because it kept what they thought were liberal activist judges out of their way. Fast forward 40 years and what's happened? Well, it's actually relatively hard for Republicans and conservatives to ensure long-term control over the executive branch, but it's relatively easy for them now that they have this supermajority on the Supreme Court to control regulation through the courts for the next 20 or 30 years. And so that's why Thomas, the rest of the conservatives have flipped on this issue. Remember, Chevron, again, if you go back to 1984, this was a decision trumpeted by the then Reagan EPA head, who was Neil Gorsuch's mom. Right? So Neil Gorsuch's mom wanted Chevron in the 80s when she was in control of the executive branch. Now that Neil Gorsuch is one of the people in control of the Supreme Court, all of a sudden, no, they don't want Chevron anymore. They want the courts to have the say. And so to roll it all back together, and I agree with everything Mustafa has said, but you got to remember, when we're talking about a power grab, who is the power coming from? We know where it's going to. We know it's going to the conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court. But who is it coming from? Because a lot of conservatives and Republicans are trying to gaslight people and tell them, well, we're just taking power from unelected bureaucrats at the EPA and giving it to unelected bureaucrats on the Supreme Court. No. They're taking power from you. They're taking power from the voters, because the voters, through their votes of Congress and the president, get to decide what laws and regulations we have. But when you take power out of the executive branch, you take power away from the one elected official we all are allowed to vote for, the president of the United States. and you give it to unelected people at the Supreme Court who don't change their minds every 4 or 8 years. The only change that can only be changed, upon retirement or death every 20 or 30 years. That's the power grab here. It's taking power out of our hands, out of the democracy's hands, and putting it in the hands of the court.
And the court where justices think nitrogen oxide, such a serious pollutant, is nitrous oxide.
Couldn't be more on point for how non-expert the court is than having literal Neil Gorsuch confuse laughing gas for smog in an opinion where he said the EPA cannot regulate smog.
Well, in another 6-3 ruling on Friday, justices ruled that local governments can criminalize sleeping and camping on public property, banning encampments of unhoused people. In a scathing dissent joined by Justices Kagan and Jackson, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote for the minority, "Sleep is a biological necessity, not a crime. For some people, sleeping outside is their only option. For people with no access to shelter, that punishes them for being homeless. That is unconscionable and unconstitutional," she said. Can you respond to this decision, Ellie?
Yeah, so Neil Gorsuch, who wrote the majority opinion for the Republicans, basically doesn't think the Eighth Amendment is allowed to exist, right? Like, this is actually a part of a long string of Gorsuch cases where he has written the Eighth Amendment out of the Constitution. Nothing is too cruel for Neil Gorsuch, and no punishment is unusual. So in this opinion, he wrote that criminalizing people, throwing people in jail for the crime of not having any place else to sleep but outside is not an Eighth Amendment law violation. It is not cruel and unusual. Neil Gorsuch, and I wish I was making this up, literally analogized sleeping on the street in Oregon because you have no place to live to campers or perhaps people who are camping out because they wanted concert tickets. It's the same thing, according to Neil Gorsuch. And so just like the city or the county can say, hey, you can't camp outside Ticketmaster just because you really want to see Pearl Jam, is they can use that same law to take homeless people who have no place else to go and send them to jail as well. Neil Gorsuch found no difference between that. It is a cruel decision, and I would go so far as to say it is an evil decision. There is something broken with people who look at people who have no place else to go, who look at people sleeping on the street, who look at people sleeping in their cars because they have no homes, and say, you know what? Get that person in a jail cell. That's where they belong. There's something broken about that, about people who do that. And unfortunately, 6 of those broken people control the Supreme Court for the rest of my natural life.
Ellie, before we go, can you lay out what's at stake in today's highly anticipated ruling on former President Donald Trump's bid for immunity from his federal indictment for trying to subvert the 2020 election and stay in power? And again, even the significance of this putting this to today, extending the term, it's something that they could have decided months ago.
Yeah, speaking of broken and damaged people, right? Look. Donald Trump has already won. Jack Smith asked the Supreme Court to resolve this issue on December 11th of 2023. The Supreme Court has had all of this time to deliberate and consider whether or not Donald Trump is absolutely immune from everything, which itself is a ridiculous position. And even if they disagree with that position here on June 1st at the end of the term, Donald Trump has already won because Donald Trump only made that ridiculous, unconstitutional, ahistorical, stupid argument in order to delay the commencement of his trial until after the election. And because the Supreme Court is only ruling on it today, that goal has already been accomplished. All that we're waiting for today is the kind of the shouting. I do not think that today the Supreme Court will agree that presidents are absolutely immune for everything. What I do think they'll say is that presidents are immune for some things, but not other things. But who can say which things are which? And they will send the case back down to the lower court for some other ruling on what acts official or unofficial, a president might could be immune for. That ruling will have to happen in the lower courts. That will get appealed to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That will get appealed to the Supreme Court. And so if Donald Trump loses the next election, there is a high chance that this time next year, we will be sitting right here, Amy, waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on the appeal of Donald Trump's appeal. And only then will we see whether or not Trump can be prosecuted for his alleged crimes that he committed on January 6, 2001, 2021, when he tried to overthrow the government.
Ellie Mistal, I want to thank you for being with us. Nation's justice correspondent. We'll link to all your pieces. He's the author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. We also want to thank Mustafa Ali, former head of the Environmental Justice Program at the Environmental Protection Agency, now Executive Vice President of National Wildlife Federation and CEO of Revitalization Strategies. Next up, how the publisher of The Washington Post allegedly helped cover up a scandal. That's the headline of our guest's latest piece. We'll also talk about the Biden-Trump debate fallout. Stay with us. Plant is Dying by Squirrel Flower. In March, the band joined other musicians in pulling out of the South by Southwest Music Festival to protest its, quote, ties to the defense industry and in support of the Palestinian people, unquote. Last week, South by Southwest announced, quote, after careful consideration, we're revising our sponsorship model. As a result, the U.S. Army and companies who engage in weapons manufacturing will not be sponsors of South by Southwest 2025. Well, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with media news and the unfolding ethics scandal at The Washington Post that's rocked the paper's newsroom and raised questions about the future of one of the leading U.S. news outlets. A British editor who was tapped for a top position at The Washington Post will no longer take that post as outcry continues to mount over a plan to shake up the Post newsroom. The editor, Robert Winnett, will now stay at the Daily Telegraph in Britain instead of coming to The Washington Post. The decision comes days after it was revealed that Winnett had a history of using fraudulently obtained phone and company records and newspaper articles. The Post chief executive, Will Lewis, is also coming under scrutiny over his record. Both Lewis and Winnett are veterans of British papers owned by Robert Murdoch. The Guardian also recently revealed Lewis advised then UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and top officials to, quote, clean up their phones in public amidst public uproar over government violations of COVID-19 safety precautions in what became known as Partygate in the UK. Will Lewis has also been accused of trying to suppress stories about his connection to the phone hacking scandal at Rupert Murdoch's News of the World newspaper in Britain. The owner of The Washington Post, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, has supported Lewis. For more, we're joined by Chris Layman, D.C. bureau chief for The Nation, where his recent piece is headlined How the Publisher of The Washington Post Allegedly Helped Cover Up a Scandal. Chris, welcome back to Democracy Now! It was great having you on Friday responding to the debate between Trump and Biden, and we're going to ask you to talk a little more about the fallout from the weekend. But first, lay out what's happening at The Washington Post.
Well, it's Not good, Amy. Will Lewis is basically the successor to Katharine Graham, the famed publisher who stood up to the Nixon administration in the Pentagon Papers and the Watergate scandals. And Lewis is sort of playing the part of a Nixon apparatchik in this Boris Johnson scandal. He went to great lengths to tell Johnson aides not to disclose sensitive communications after a public investigation was launched in the Partygate scandal. And as you noted, this is on top of the whole phone hacking scandal. There's actually been another report in the New York Times since I wrote my piece for The Nation, in which investigators for Scotland Yard detailed to the phone hacking case say that Lewis did not disclose what turned out to be millions of sensitive emails as he claimed initially to have done. So you have the leading executive for one of the nation's great newspapers in this position of covering up both for Boris Johnson when he was running a political consultancy and covering up for himself. And at the most basic level of how journalism should operate, executives in charge of news in the public interest should not be suppressing news. It's a pretty simple bar, and Will Lewis has failed to clear it, clearly.
Can you talk about the relationship between Wynette and Will Lewis, with Will Lewis saying he's so sorry to lose his colleague as a result of the outcry? But the two of them, I guess you could say Murdochians from Britain, people who work for Rupert Murdoch, work together and are being investigated together.
That's right. Basically, Wynette was a protege of Will Lewis at the Telegraph, and they worked together on these stories involving what's called a blagger, which is someone hired on contract to misrepresent himself to obtain information that would be embarrassing to various institutions and figures. And what's sort of, this is typical of the British tabloid press. The information they sought was kind of banal and not of any great public interest. There was a reporting on a Manchester United ownership spat, and then a story about rich Britons who were lining up to buy a luxury Mercedes vehicle. And under British law, you can use sort of sketchy means of obtaining information if it serves a public interest. It's very, very difficult to see how any of these stories met that standard. So, you have this kind of squalid tabloid culture that produces titillating clicks, and that appears to be what Jeff Bezos wanted at the Washington Post. And boy, is he getting a full dose of it.
And before we pivot to the debate, Chris, I wanted to ask you about the level of outcry in the Washington Post newsroom, having people like the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Marinus and others actually speaking out and writing articles. Some of the best coverage of the debacle at the Washington Post is the Washington Post.
Yes, and that was to the credit of Sally Busby. One of these episodes involved Lewis reportedly strong-arming Sally Busby to not cover a new development in the civil suit involving the phone hacking scandal. And she went ahead and did it anyway and resigned shortly afterwards. Lewis denies having done that, but, David Fulfenflick, an NPR reporter, has written that he tried the same tactic with him when Fulfenflick was considering doing an article about Lewis. And Lewis basically said, I'll give you an exclusive so long as you don't write about this phone hacking business. So again, suppressing information is bad for journalism. It's sad that we live in an age where this, has to be reiterated. But and that is why people like David Marinus and a lot of other people at the Post are really distressed, and a lot of talented reporters are, reportedly eyeing the exits. And you know, it's a sad. I came to Washington originally to work for the Washington Post, and a big reason was Katherine Graham's ownership. You know, as a family-owned newspaper that stood up to the state, that is what journalism should be. Now we have a Washington Post that's owned by an absentee billionaire who just apparently likes the Rupert Murdoch business model and has been pushing it in that direction. It's really a sad and scandalous set of developments.
Chris, I want to continue our conversation from Friday.
Yes.
But let me quote the Philadelphia Inquirer. To serve his country, Donald Trump should leave the race. Biden had a horrible night Thursday, but the debate about the debate is misplaced. The only person who should withdraw from the race is Trump. That was the headline in the Philadelphia Inquirer Friday after Thursday's first presidential debate between Presidents Biden and Trump. But others were much more focused on Biden. The New York Times headlined its editorial Friday, to serve his country, President Biden should leave the race. Washington Post columnist David Ignatius wrote a piece headlined, why Biden didn't accept the truth that was there for all to see. And the New Yorker's David Remnick wrote in a piece headlined, the reckoning of Joe Biden, quote, for Biden to remain the Democratic candidate would be an act not only of self-delusion, but of national endangerment. To go on contending that his good days are more plentiful than the bad, to ignore the inevitability of time and aging, doesn't merely risk his legacy, it risks the election. Chris, you've been following all of this. President Biden was supposedly hunkered down at Camp David with his family to make a decision on this. Apparently, though, they were there for an Annie Leibovitz family shoot yesterday, a photo shoot. Talk about the fallout.
Well, it's uncharted territory in American politics, that's for sure. And, out of all those quotes from those various pieces, you know, we're in a moment where both things are true, right? Like, Donald Trump should not be a major party nominee, as my colleague Ellie Mistel noted at the end of his appearance with you. He tried to overthrow the government. That's kind of it's not upholding the Constitution, which is in the oath of office. The Biden situation has not improved after a week of reflection about the future of the campaign. It appears that the Biden and his inner circle of advisors are doubling down. They're going to proceed full steam ahead. And, you know, this is after a CBS poll in the wake of the debate found that 72% of Americans don't think that Biden is cognitively up to the job of being president. I don't know how you battle back against that. Gretchen Whitmer, who is governor of Michigan, reportedly called Biden's campaign and said Michigan is no longer really in play for the president, which, you know, it's important to pan back and realize the reason this debate happened when it did was the Biden campaign was taking the risk that it would turn things around, especially they've been trailing in all the swing states, which, as we know from bitter experience, is, regardless of the popular vote, a ticket to losing the election. So they took this incredible risk to do this debate in which Biden performed in a way that really troubles everyone following our politics. And they're now saying it's a greater risk to change horses, and the risk has already been taken.
Chris Layman of The Nation, thanks so much. A very happy birthday to Isis Phillipson. We have a job opening, Director of Development, apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Hello. This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.